Welcome, weary travelers, to Rogues in the House, where the talk of sword and sorcery comes alive with a ferocity that would make Crom himself nod in approval. We beckon you into a realm where steel clashes with magic, where heroes are born of blood and fire. Join us as we delve into the forgotten depths and the new paths of sword and sorcery, where rogues and warriors alike carve their legends upon the annals of time. So grasp your swords tightly, hold fast to your spells, for in this podcast, adventure awaits those brave enough to tread the shadowed paths of the unknown.
Hey, welcome back to the Rogues in the House, everyone. This is going to be a interesting episode, I think, primarily because we're down a rogue.
Yeah, and for once, it's not me. It's
yes, it's not the rogue that sometimes is missing.
Matt had some oral surgery, I guess, and he's not feeling up to it, which is fine. We're going to continue on with our exploration of people's origin stories.
Right, our exploration of, well, I guess we're calling it Rogues React Part 2.
Yeah.
We had so many that we couldn't really do it all in one, comfortably 1 hour episode.
Right.
So we're breaking it up into two, and this is our part two. This is our foray into part two. Do we want to do a bazaar of the bizarre before we start?
Yeah, why not? You got something to start off with?
Well, yeah. We were talking a little bit off mic. I thought I would go ahead and mention it. I was up at the GaryCon convention in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin this last weekend, and I got to meet one of our listeners, and it was really kind of interesting because it wasn't until the game was over, I think, I could be remembering wrong because it was a long day, that he said, "Hey, I'm a listener, I'm a fan of the Rogues in the House, and I just thought it was really kind of neat to be playing a game with you." It was Nolabert, his name's Robert, but Nolabert was in my game. I was playing the Thunder Road Vendetta, which is kind of a Mad Max themed
I was
going to
say, it sounds Mad Max-y.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was in the game, and it was a lot of fun. It was kind of cool to meet people who were listening to us.
Yeah. And I don't have a ton of sword and sorcery related, but I guess this is a little more like pulp related in general. I've been, you know, I like just like the, I hate to call it generic adventure. But mm-hmm. like what you'd think of when you think of adventure. There's a website called internetarchive.org, I believe. And I think they lost a lawsuit fairly recently. So they had to take a bunch of stuff off because like it's still in print. But a lot of stuff that's not in print, you can still look at scans of it. And they got a lot of old pulp magazines. Specifically, I'm thinking of like adventure and jungle stories.
Mm-hmm.
Which has like, you know, the images and everything in it, because they're just scanned straight off a page. And I've been reading through some stories in there, and they're really fun. You know, they're dated and all the things that you would expect with that, but I think they're fun. There's some good authors in there that, I think people don't really talk about very much because they're not like, I feel like, at least in my experience, and maybe that has to do with my own origin story, that the Weird Tales crew gets most of the love. H.P. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, all of them. But there were so many, and what's interesting to me is, like, what we consider, like, sword and sorcery or even weird fiction was not the bulk of pulp fiction. That was just, like, one of the many, and adventure, the magazine, and Thrilling Tales and Argosy were all pretty generic adventure, sometimes historical, that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of dominated the market. And then there were some horror and there was some weird fiction and yada yada, but there's also like sports and westerns and all kinds of stuff. And it doesn't seem like there's as big of community, a niche for that kind of stuff like there is sword and sorcery. It kind of makes me wonder why, you know, sword and sorcery you know, had the staying power or has attracted a core group of people that continue to like do that stuff. And like pulp adventure has, you know, transformed into, you know, kind of adopted the novel format, because a lot of it was very contemporary of the time, so it just kind of moved along with time. And as an author who writes adjacent stuff, fiction that's set during what we would consider like the pulp time period, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, it doesn't really sell on the market. And I've always kind of, it's just kind of interesting to me. But that's kind of where my head's at been lately. So,
Are you using it for any type of inspiration for your own writing?
oh, sometimes I like to think, I have, Dean, I got so many ideas,
I know you
but
do.
ideas are so easy to create. It's actually finding the time to sit down and write something that's difficult. And I've been very, very busy as of late. We have
Well,
another alt.
yes.
Yeah.
You have a good
Yeah.
reason to be busy,
Yes,
and you're going to
yes.
be even busier. But as a two-time father, I will have to tell you, you're going to have to make time for
Oh,
those things
yeah,
that
I
you love.
know. Yes. Which I think is a problem I have in general. I spend a lot of time either working on just work or like vegging out, and I need to really cut out some of that vegging out time and focus on the things that I love.
Absolutely. I'm
So.
looking for the next episode of The Weird West, or what was it
Oh,
called?
yeah. God, now I can't even. Why can't I even think of it? Yeah. But yeah,
It's your
my it is my
podcast.
podcast. And my mom asked me about it the other day because their best friends were on a road trip and listened to a couple episodes and they loved it. And I love making it. It's just an extensive amount of time to research, write, and then edit
Yes.
and record. And it doesn't make like it's purely, for the love of it. And if I ha was like a, a streamer or YouTuber that had like a crew of people that to like, do that stuff, but I don't. So hopefully I can get back on that soon. It's on my list.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, get through the arrival of your child, and then you'll
Yes.
figure out, because the kid will turn the kid will adjust to your schedule.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep. And you know what? When you're up late at night changing his or her his or her her
Her.
changing her diaper, or trying to put her to sleep, or just being awake, you know what? Maybe grab that that laptop and do a little typing while you're
Yeah,
there.
I think, I've heard other people say that. Same with books. I think that'll probably be like my reading time when I'm up late. Yep, sure. Yep. So,
Yep.
yeah.
Well,
So.
anyway, that was our little trip down to the bazaar. I do want to say something. Speaking to Nolibert, who is in my Thunder Road game, I want to say thanks for, reaching out and saying you're a fan of the Rogues and you appreciate what we're doing. And it was really great to have you in the game. You're a good player in that game. And if I remember right, I think he won both games.
I think he said that in the Discord. Yeah, I think he
Yeah.
said,
So
yeah.
cool. Very cool. All right. Well, let's get into this Rogues React Part 2. We're going to be listening to some people, their first brush with sword and sorcery, and then we're going to kind of react to it. Our first one is Nicholas Perez, and he is from Southern Indiana. So we're getting a little Midwestern love here. I'm from Illinois, and I think that Southern Indiana is a beautiful place. So, this is Nicholas Perez. So here goes.
Hello, my name is Nicholas Perez, and I'm from Southern Indiana. And my first brush with the sword and sorcery genre was The Birthgrave, the debut novel by Tanith Lee back in 1975. It was a raw and strange novel, but still very good, and it kicked off a trilogy that was equal parts weird, colorful, and still very good, even though it ended rather unsettlingly. The Birthgrave was unique to me because it was a deconstruction of women in sword and sorcery at the time. It looked at the different roles and positions women occupied in the genre and kind of showed how they really couldn't just be in one box or the other. It was fluid. Tanith Lee opened up to me what you could do with sword and sorcery, and I've since then looked into Elric and to Conan and some of the other sword and sorceries that Lee herself wrote. It's definitely a very strange book, and but given that Tanith Lee, she's not as widely known as she once was, I do highly recommend it for people who want to get into her works and into sword and sorcery in general, because it was one of the books published during the 70s resurgence of sword and sorcery.
That's super interesting. I've one, not read any Tanith Lee, and I've two, never heard of that book.
I would have to say the same exact thing. I knew a lot of people who did read Tanith Lee. I was not one of them, but I've never heard of that. I've never heard of that book.
I'm just I had to look it up, and like I mean, it does sound wild in the Wikipedia synopsis. And it looks like it's actually based on some dreams that she had herself when she was in her 20s. So like, 408 pages, so it's hefty. But Daw Books, 1975. Huh, that's interesting.
I'm curious as to how Nicholas picked. I don't know how old Nicholas is, but if he said it was the introduction, her very first book, her debut book in 75, either Nicholas is sounds a lot younger than he really is, or he picked it up, certainly well after it's been published. And I mean, that's how I discovered a lot of the books. And, the books I started with had been out 10 or 15 years, and I'm picking them up, afterwards. They were hand-me-downs. So, but that's kind of cool. Tanith Lee, we may have to put that on our reading list.
I think it's really interesting. Like, I guess I just assumed most people would come into Sword and Sorcery via Conan. So it's cool to hear people
Absolutely.
come in from a different route.
Yeah.
Like last time we talked about, oh, the guy with the awesome name and the awesome voice,
Yes,
Lazan.
Visant.
Yeah, Visant. Yeah, with Jarell of Juari. But
Yes.
yeah, yes, very cool, very cool.
Yeah, so Nicholas came in from a totally different angle than most of us, and I think that's what we found in the first part, was that a lot of it was either certainly in that resurgence of sword and sorcery in the 70s and 80s, but it was a lot of it came through the artwork or maybe the comic books for many of those people who submitted the first in the first half or the first part. So, okay. Thank you, Nicholas, for submitting that. It is greatly appreciated. Next up is Brent Partner from Auckland, New Zealand. Brent and I are friends on Facebook. I don't know if you are or not, but we actually talk. We talk quite a bit on Messenger. Seems like a really nice guy, and I do intend to make it to New Zealand, so
That'd
I'm
be
definitely
cool.
going to meet up with him and Ricardo Ball at some point. So maybe I can even do a little couch surfing while I'm there. So, okay, let's listen to Brent Partner.
Hi, I'm Brent Partner from Auckland, New Zealand. I think my first brush with sword and sorcery was when I was six. We were in a flooded campground with nothing to do, and us kids were plonked in front of a TV and we watched Jason and the Argonauts. I loved everything about it. By the time I was nine, I was an accomplished reader, just finishing Lord of the Rings for the first time. I really have to search my mind to recall what sword and sorcery stories I read first, but I can narrow it down to either Moorcock's Sojourn the Swordsman, or Knight of the Swords, or Howard's Worms of the Earth. Le Guin's Wizard of Earthsea fits in there somewhere too, but I don't really remember. It was all just fantasy to me then. At the time, I was becoming interested in metal and punk, and became immersed in comics like 2000 AD and Savage Sword of Conan. In 1982, Milius's Masterwork came out, and I was in awe. I was indelibly marked for life. I started my working life in trades. For 15 years, I worked on power stations, building sites, mine sites, and in factories. I didn't have so much time for reading then. But then in my 30s, I did an honours degree in lit to learn how to become a writer. I then moved into academic librarianship, and I began reading what I now know to be sword and sorcery. I've concluded that sword and sorcery are blue-collar stories of the fantastic for blue-collar readers. It always has been, and hopefully always will be. While I've enjoyed reading academic papers and listened to debate and discussion, I cannot help but feel that this working-class facet of this fiction is somehow overlooked. Sword and sorcery characters align more to the base humour and honest emotion I found in people I work with in trades. They have harder lives and live for those lightning-in-a-bottle moments that those lives bring. Moments like when you realise you've walked into the wrong bar, wondering if you're going to survive the press of a mosh pit, or stepping into the ring and wondering through the fear if you're going to leave with as many IQ points as you did when you entered. Sword and Sorcery is metal, sometimes erotic, its low-born gallows humour and those heroic moments in the places where they'll never be noticed.
All right, that was Brent Partner from Auckland, New Zealand, and that's a great analogy there about Sword and Sorcery being blue collar. I like that. I like that. Yeah. I know that there's a lot of white collar people who still enjoy Sword and Sorcery, but that tracks very well being blue collar.
I agree. And I mean, I think, you know, as a product of the pulps, it was, you know, they were stories meant for cheap thrills and, you know, in many mm-hmm. circles that still like look down upon that kind of like, I don't want to call it trashy, but like,
yeah,
you know, your B movie stuff. And I think that is an important facet. And I don't want to say that like, Matt and I interact with a lot of people through Discord, and a lot of them do come from other circles. Especially like academic circles, I feel like, and that does exist, but personally, my heart is always in the blue collar side of it. Like he said, rougher lives, mm-hmm.
Lightning, you know, in a bottle,
lightning in a bottle is what he said. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I, in a lot of ways, I think Sword and Sorcery echoes the Western. I know people, older gentlemen and some women, who basically only read Louis L'Amour books their entire life and never picked up another book because they're four blue-collar people and they relate to those stories.
Yes.
And you know, that's what they are. And it's kind of like the whole spirit of the thing. And I think that's an important aspect. And I do think that kind of gets overlooked a lot when we talk about Sword and Sorcery. I also, so he mentioned Jason the Argonauts, and while I didn't see that one till later, I had mentioned my first fantasy movie was probably Beastmaster, but I did watch Clash of the Titans as a kid because my dad showed it to me because he likes yeah. it. And you know what? And I would agree that they are Sword and Sorcery, but in my mind, I do not consider, I don't even consider them fantasy. Like if I were going to list fantasy movies, I wouldn't list those. And I don't know why. They're clearly fantasy, but there's something special about them. I don't know, that kind of sets them apart. Harryhausen movies in general.
Yeah.
So I think the Sinbad movies, big fan. Absolutely. Watch the Sinbad movies.
Yeah. I was going to say the Sinbad movies are definitely Sword and Sorcery, I think. But like Brent said, at that point, everything was fantasy. And I agree. It was the same thing for me. I didn't know there was a genre difference between, you know, the Conan I was reading, or maybe the Elric that I was reading or watching on TV or something like that. It was just fantasy.
And I don't know, because I don't study this stuff and I don't really read epic fantasy, but I have to wonder if like the things kind of diverged when, you know, like epic fantasy became bigger. I don't know if that's 70s, 80s, whatever. When you got sort of like the Lord of the Rings school of writing. Because, like, for me, if I'm going to put a Harryhausen movie, if I'm going to lump it in with something, it's going to be with, like, swashbuckling Errol Flynn movies and stuff like that. And that's just what they were. And I, like I said, I wouldn't even consider it fantasy, despite it obviously being fantasy. But it's not that different than, like, Robin Hood or Zorro or the Three Musketeers. It just happens to have a Cyclops in it.
I think you could just call it action is what we were watching and reading. Action books, action movies, action television.
Yeah.
And when you're young and dumb and impressionable, that's, you know, what you're just going to watch. And that's what you're going to call it. I didn't care. I am not an intellectual in the sense like you and Matt are in terms of like, you know, being our authors and such. But I just know what I like. And kind of like what Brent said, you know, it's it was something that grabbed him at a young age. I don't know what type of campground he goes to that they have a TV where he can watch Jason and the Argonauts.
Man, I'd love to do an episode on Harryhausen movies. That'd be
That would be cool. That would be cool. I would be into watching a bunch of those.
Oh, yeah.
So, all right. Well, thanks, Brent, for sending that in. Much appreciated. Now, next up is a good friend of mine who I was at Gary Con with. His name's Jimmy McGuire. He's from Central Illinois, and he and I,
Jimmy.
yeah, Jimmy, we've we spend a lot of time together. Actually, we were
That's
college
cool.
classmates. He lived upstairs. I lived downstairs in the same apartment complex.
Sure.
So anyway, this is Jimmy McGuire from Central Illinois.
Hi, this is Jimmy McGuire. My introduction to Conan the Cimmerian by Robert E. Howard goes back to when I was 10. My father tried to get me to have a love of books like he had by buying me Zane Grey and Sherlock Holmes and the different kinds of books that were appealing to young boys at the time. But when I was looking through the local bookstore in Kankakee, I found Frank Frazetta's artwork on the very first Conan the Cimmerian book, the soft cover, published back in 1969, I found. And obviously Frazetta's artwork grabs a young boy's imagination. So I bought the book, $2.25, and never looked back. Conan had the teenage years of wanderlust that so many other boys had at the time, growing up in small towns, wanted to get away from the doldrums of the farm life. And reading Conan took all of us to a different world that was created in Howard's imagination. I haven't looked back. I bought all 12 of the original series with Robert E. Howard, Lynn Carter, and L. Sprague DeCamp. And I have enjoyed the stories throughout my life and all that has brought with it, the comic books and the games and different books that have been written by other authors. So that fateful day back when I was 10 years old, finding Frank Frazetta's artwork appealing has led me to a lifelong love of Robert E. Howard's and Conan the Cimmerian's stuff. Have a great day, Dean.
All right, I'll have to agree with him probably 9 times out of 10. It's the artwork on a book that's going to grab you and make you pick it up.
That's so interesting to me. And like, I know I'm not a majority here. I don't despise the art itself. I don't. It's obviously good art. I like it. I like looking at it. But I like generic covers.
What do you mean by like, generic?
I don't know. What was it? The S.M. Sterling Conan novel. That came out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's got like a sword and like the title on it and the name of the author are like thrillers. Just have the name and like some vague associated symbolism or like a Dan Brown book just has like a picture of Mona Lisa on it. I love that.
Yeah.
So,
I get what you're saying. I think it's a sign of the times. I think that back when these books were coming out, you know, Frazetta had made all these prints and such, and it just made sense that the owners of the Conan copyright and licensing would just use that and put it on because it's a selling point. You know, if you
100%.
Like good art, if you like good art. But I have to agree with you because some of that artwork that comes out, like especially the Joe Abercrombie English editions or UK editions of his books, the cover artwork is generic, like you say, but
yeah,
it's so cool. It is so very cool.
I like minimalist. I like the I don't know what you want to call it. Digital like layers of things. I don't mind that, and I do find. I mean, and it makes sense in the sword and sorcery community that where, a number of people, you know, came in through Frazetta and, you know, adjacent artists that they would be like, oh, those are ugly and boring. Maybe.
Yeah.
At least
well,
for me.
And I think that for them to use that type of artwork on those books back in the day, you're more likely than not to get a younger crowd to pick up those books.
Sure.
Don't you
that
think?
Makes sense.
Because
yeah.
If it had been a more generic image on the book, you know, Conan, and that was it, you know, maybe
yeah.
a sword,
that's fair.
It may not have been as attractive to a young man. And I do agree with Jimmy. We're both from small towns. We didn't know it, but we grew up like 35 miles away from each other.
That's
And,
funny. That's funny.
you know, my parents weren't rich. They certainly weren't poor, but we definitely didn't have a lot of money. So there wasn't a lot of travel. There wasn't a lot of things that we went out and did and stuff like that. So I was reading those books as escapism,
Right,
and
right.
I could not get enough of them. And I'd mow yards or I'd bale hay or things like that. And anytime I got a chance to go anywhere where there was a book rack, one of those spinning book racks,
Yeah.
I'd always be looking for things, and bam, there'd be an image of this cover art that would attract my eye, and I'd pick it up. You know, I'd look at the artwork and see if it was up to snuff, of course, and then of course you
Sure,
turn it over
sure.
to the back to see what the description is. But it was the artwork first and foremost that grabbed me at that point. But I do
I
agree with you, the
also I like and I also think it's difficult. There are obviously a number of, working artists that do sword and sorcery art right now, whether like high-end professional on like a Del Rey cover or doing commissions or whatever.
Right.
We've paid for some to cover Book of Blades, and they're great at what they do, but Frank Frazetta set the bar so high.
Yes.
It's so incredibly difficult to mimic
Yeah.
that look. And I don't know if I could name anyone that comes
No.
comfortably close. It's just a really high bar to beat, and maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, I think that for the next Book of Blades, you should have like a bodice ripper type of
Love
cover
it.
art.
Love
Yeah,
it. Yeah.
definitely. I think that's what you
Yeah.
need. Some guy's like
Oh.
oiled up and completely
Yeah.
hairless, and he's
Yeah.
grabbing a sword in a very
Oh
seductive
yeah. It's
way.
really
Yeah.
gonna sell copies.
Yes, it will. You never know.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. The next one up is Henry Gabb, and he is from Austin, Texas. Now, also, Henry is a friend of mine. He too was at
Oh.
Gary Con. So I've got a couple of my friends submitting some stuff here. Henry, I know this story of how he did it, how he became first involved with sword and sorcery, because he told it to me on our way to Howard Days a few years ago. And it's
That's cool.
really interesting, and it is totally random. So here's Henry Gabb.
Hey, Dean. My first exposure to sword and sorcery, or Robert E. Howard in particular, was complete random luck. I was sitting in the library as an undergrad studying at LSU, and I used to go study in the part of the library where the English dissertations were shelved. And I took a break and I just grabbed one at random off the shelf and started flicking through it. And it was a dissertation about 1930s pulp literature with an emphasis on Robert Howard. And I thought, I didn't know who Robert Howard was. So I started digging a little deeper, skimming, and thought, oh, he's the guy who wrote Conan, the Conan the Barbarian. And this was a few years after the movie had come out. And I hadn't seen the movie. But I thought, okay, this guy who wrote this dissertation is he's writing pretty favorably about the Conan stories and about the work of Robert Howard. So I went to the bookstore and I picked up one of the old Tor collections of Conan short stories that were the ones with the Robert Vallejo pictures on the cover. Boris Vallejo, sorry. And I read it and I thought, wow, this is pretty good stuff. I think I'll buy the rest of them. And from there, the rest is history. I've been a big fan of Robert Howard and the pulp authors from the 30s ever since then.
So he literally pulled a dissertation off of a library shelf, flicked it open, and was introduced to Robert E. Howard.
That's funny. Yeah, that is random.
That is totally random. How cool is that, though?
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever pulled a dissertation off a shelf.
Yeah, I mean, when exactly. I mean, aside from the people who read the dissertation to give you your degree or not, they're probably never read ever again by anybody.
And yeah, just randomly and picking one and ta-da,
Yeah. And
life-changing moment.
Yeah, he did also. Henry also contacted me, and he misspoke. It's not Boris Vallejo; it is Frank Frazetta. That's what he was talking about. So
Oh,
again,
okay.
yeah, again, another reference to Frank Frazetta. He was having a brain fart or something, I guess. But you know, to I know Henry, and Henry is a very intelligent man, and he's very discerning in what he reads. But he absolutely loves the pulp fiction stuff,
That's awesome.
and it's a shared commonality between the two of us. So we, when we get together, we do a lot of talking about the books we're reading or the shows we've seen. He's a big gamer like me, and I guess we're both kind of old school in that way. We like a lot of the older games that were coming out before we were actually even knew what gaming was. You know, we were kids, and then we
Sure.
rediscover them in our early teens or whatever. But the same with the books. We like a lot of the stuff that was written before we were actually truly able to read, I guess, or at least understand what we were reading.
I mean, there is a lot of style has changed a lot. Like, I read a lot of books, and most of them are actually modern, but there is a certain, oh, I don't know, excitement. Like a certain flair in old stuff. And I wonder if it's like a product of, you know, these guys were, and sometimes ladies were spitting out, you know, a short story now is typically like 7,500 words, 500 words, something like that. But, you know, even the shortest Robert E. Howard stories are twice as long, easy. And they're pumping them out, trying to get money to fill their post-depression, like Great Depression coffers as like a business, as their job. And so, you know, they're just right, send it off, right, send it off. And I have to wonder if that kind of like, you know, pushes it out.
Yeah, I don't know. I have found myself going back and rereading a lot of stuff that I read as a kid. I know there's a lot of good new stuff out there. But I guess I'm afraid to take a chance on some of this stuff because if I, you know, invest, books are not cheap anymore.
No, books are not cheap anymore, which is unfortunate because, like, that's why I have a lot on my e-reader. I also take a lot of advantage of my library,
Yeah,
except
and I
library is
probably
mostly
should.
like hardcover books, and they're so hard to
Yeah.
carry around.
Yeah.
But
But I've been looking at my library that I have here at home, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I haven't read that in 20 years. I might as well read
sure.
it. I'm actually going to be picking up. I just got done rereading. I read the Canterbury Tales. I just got done with La Morte d'Arthur by Thomas Malory from the 1500s or the 1400s, I guess. And I don't know. I think I'm going to pick up some of these older books that I haven't read in a long, long time because, damn, they're great.
Whatever brings you joy.
Right. All right. Next up is a sometime rogue, and we all know him and love him because he's the guy who determined that. Oh my gosh, I'm forgetting the name of the movie that we reviewed. Deathstalker 2. That Deathstalker 2 is the epitome of sword and sorcery. Here's Brian Murphy.
Hey guys, it's Brian Murphy, author of Flame and Crimson and former Rogue in the House. Thought I'd give you my sword and sorcery origin story. We had a used comic book shop in my hometown of Reading, Massachusetts. And at the time I was collecting Marvel comics like Captain America, Thor, Avengers primarily. And one day I was in there, happened to glance down, and there was a cardboard box on the floor, bunch of magazines in there. They were sort of standing upright, so I couldn't tell what they were. Spine was facing up, and I pulled one out, and it was Savage Sword of Conan number 16. You could hear the choir playing in the background as I pulled this thing out, and lights spilling across the floor of the comic book shop. It was number 16. It was the first part of People of the Black Circle. And I started flipping through it. Well, first the cover had Conan battling a horde of ghouls and a bloody axe and a half-naked woman, of course. Amazing artwork, amazing articles, which of course I was drawn to. There was a Swords and Scrolls letters page featuring a lengthy letter from Yasmina, Flower of the Dawn. Who was a belly dancer who attended a comic book convention, so was scantily clad. All of that appealed to my 10 or 11-year-old sensibilities, and I was off.
Wow.
If we could pull all of our listeners at what age they were when they got introduced to sword and sorcery, I wonder how many of them would say, oh, that was probably between 10 and 13 when your hormones are just starting to rage.
I noticed there's there's been a lot of that. I love hearing Murphy's voice. He's got a good voice. He's a good storyteller. I gotta tell you, Brian, I went and tried to look up a picture of Yasmina Flower of the Dawn plus belly dancer. I couldn't find anything, which makes me a little disappointed. So if you got pictures, you should share. But I also looked up the cover of that comic, and you described it exactly. Very, very good.
I do recall that because I had that. I didn't subscribe, but I would go always to the comic book store and find those Sword and Sorcery, Savage Swords of Conan.
Well, and they got I guess it's a relaunch. Savage Sword has been relaunched when the same format and everything. Not being a huge comic guy, I haven't ran out to pick it up. I've heard good things other than some printing issues. But I know a lot of people are really hyped to see the magazine size back in action.
So. Yep, I am hoping to pick it up. I went online to Titan and was just going to buy direct from them, and it was sold out.
Ooh, well, good.
Yeah,
no, it's sold always out. Good to hear that the sales are good for that stuff.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's always good to hear from Brian. And
yeah.
It does not surprise me that that's how he was introduced to Sword and Sorcery. Yep. 10-year-old, 11-year-old boy where his hormones were just starting to rage. And
a little bit of skin, a little bit of blood, a muscle dude.
Perfect storm.
The Sword and Sorcery is the perfect storm for that age group.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, next up is a fairly famous person, or famous adjacent, maybe? Call it that. It is Sarah Frazetta from Sarasota, Florida, and I think we kind of know how she got introduced to Sword and Sorcery. So let's give a listen to Sarah.
Hello, it's Sarah Frazetta coming from Sarasota, Florida. I am the granddaughter of the fantasy artist, the godfather of fantasy art, Frank Frazetta. And my first brush with Sword and Sorcery was, of course, seeing my grandfather's art. His art was all over his house. It was all over the museum walls. And I was basically living with my grandparents till I was 6 years old. And it was just, stuck into my subconscious because it was just everywhere. It was just part of growing up, which is pretty cool. I think my cemented, this is what Sword and Sorcery moment was for me was his film that he made with Ralph Bakshi titled Fire and Ice.
Sure.
I watched that when I was 5 years old and I was hooked.
All right. No surprise there, but can you imagine living in a space where all that artwork is everywhere? I mean, that had to be amazing. But then again, she was 6 years old, so it probably didn't mean as much to her. It was just the artwork that grandpa does.
Yeah, yeah. No, it'd be crazy. I remember one time I was in an antique store, and I know that it wasn't a first printing or the real thing or whatever, but I came across a print of a Tarzan. I know it was a Tarzan cover, or at least picture of Tarzan, where he's fighting a crocodile or an alligator or whatever. Mm-hmm. And even though it was a print, I was still in awe to see a Frank Frazetta artwork in the wild. So yeah, having it just around would be something else.
And Fire and Ice, that was I think the last time I saw that, I might have still been living at home with my parents.
Oh, really? That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time since I have seen that movie. Yeah.
I've seen it a couple times. I think I watched it before we did the Spine of the Night episode just to like compare the two.
Yeah.
So I've seen them. Yeah. Ralph Bakshi movies are often nuts. I would say Fire and Ice is probably the most tame that I've actually seen.
Right.
I know that the Lord of the Rings movies that he did are a little, or Hobbit or whatever are like more PG, but they are also more of an acid trip. So
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings, the one that does the first two books, it
yeah.
is actually it's pretty damn close in terms of how it comes together. It's more accurate to the book than I think even the Lord of the
Sure,
Rings
sure.
movies are. I do believe that Jordan Smith is up next.
Hello, Rogues. This is Jordan Smith coming to you from Providence, Rhode Island. My secret origin to sword and sorcery fandom all started with seeing Conan the Barbarian, 1982. It planted the seed of the Cimmerian in my head, and shortly after that, I went on vacation to Truckee, California, and I saw a Conan comic on the spinner rack at the grocery store. And in it, Conan is holding a torch. He's plundering a chest in a cave. He's got this big chunky necklace on, and this hairy monster is looming behind him in the shadows. It was amazing. Issue 201. It was a flashback issue of young Conan, and he's escaping through the tunnels, being chased by these creatures, and it was exciting and it was terrifying, and I knew I needed more, so I begged and begged my dad to bring me back to the grocery store to get some more of the Conan comics that were on the spinner rack. I ended up getting the end of the Devourer of Souls arc, and that got me started on the James Owsley run, which is still one of my favorite runs. And I read the covers off of those issues, and that is what got me sort of launched forward into the sword and sorcery. From there, my love spread to the Beastmaster, other sword and sorcery movies of the 80s, then Liber's Fafhrd and the Great Mauser, Moorcock's Elgric, tabletop RPGs, and eventually Wagner's Cain. Thanks for the show, guys. Love what you do.
But I think this is interesting. Like, obviously, we talked about comics before, but his entrance is, I think, fairly late in the comic run. Issue 201
Well, yeah,
sounds late.
because Brian said he picked up, wait, no, this was a comic, not Savage Sword, right?
Right. I think this was Conan the
Okay.
Barbarian 201,
I would think that that is definitely late.
1970. Which is actually later, or I guess earlier than I thought it was, but it looks like it came out in 1970.
1970, really?
Oh, it says, read comic online, says Conan the Barbarian, 1970, issue number 201. But I don't
Wow.
know. Oh,
When did that?
no. It's that's when Conan the Barbarian comics started, maybe? I don't
Yes, I was
know.
going to say.
It's 92, July 14, 1992. Nope, that's Savage Sword. See, there's too many.
Yeah.
Conan the Barbarian issue, Conan the Barbarian. But still, that seems late, right?
It does seem
Like
late, you know.
201?
Right. If you've gotten
I can't
Issue
find it.
201, if
Conan the
you got it.
Barbarian, 1970, 201? 87, December 1st, 1987.
Okay.
I recognized it by the cover. It does have the giant hairy beast in the tunnel. Yeah, so 1987. I had, well, God, I'm 3 months old at that point in time. So yeah, I mean, I feel like, again, I mentioned I'm not a huge Conan person, or comic person, I mean. But comics for Conan kind of faded away in the 90s, didn't they?
I think so.
So you're kind of, he's coming in kind of towards the end of the Marvel Conan run, I think. Which is different. I feel like, a lot of people pick him up from the early ones with the iconic covers and the actual Robert E. Howard adapted stories and stuff like that. So that's
Well,
interesting.
but he also mentioned, and I think this is a good fodder for us. Beastmaster. We need to do an
Oh
episode on
yes, we do.
Beastmaster.
We absolutely do.
He's the second
Still.
or third person who mentioned Beastmaster
Yeah,
as
yep,
being
yep.
very influential in their introduction to sword and sorcery.
Definitely. So Conan the Barbarian, the comic, not Savage Sword, ran for 275 issues. It ended in December of 1993. So there were only 6 more years of that specific comic, by the time he picked it up.
Isn't it crazy how the comics have gone on longer? I mean, in terms of a run, like you're
Oh,
talking
yeah.
about there, than Robert E. Howard wrote them.
Right. I think Conan as a concept and the Hyborian Age as a concept are, oh, I don't know. I don't want to say universal. That's not the word. But they're so inspiring that there's just like an infinite well of stories that you can tell.
Right.
Granted, some of them are going to be terrible, some of them are going to be superb, but I can totally see why there's an endearing, like I can feel in my heart why there's an enduring presence of Conan, despite how small it may be now.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So our next person, second to last person, is Aaron D. Donato, and he is from Wilmington, Delaware.
Hey Rogues, this is Aaron DiDonato from Wilmington, Delaware, also known as Captain Quorum on the Whetstone Discord. And I guess my first brush with sword and sorcery, although I didn't know it, was as a kid. There was definitely a while when my two favorite TV shows were the cartoons Conan the Adventurer and Mighty Max. So obviously you know Conan the Adventurer. And Mighty Max was, well, about, equal parts science fiction, horror, or fantasy, depending on the episode. But his two companions, the main character Mighty Max always had with him, were both very sword and sorcery themed always. And they were Virgil, kind of a Merlin type owl in a cloak, and a big Viking type dude named Norman, who was all muscle and short on words and swinging his sword around. And he was my favorite character on Mighty Max. Then I was many years later until I actually knew what sword and sorcery was, and that would have been towards the end of high school when I started reading comic books again. So when I was a kid, I read a bunch of comics. And, my favorite when I was little was Fantastic Four, but I'd also pick up Arrak, Son of Thunder at the flea market, or even an issue of Captain Carrot and His Amazing Zoo Crew with Bowsar the Barbarian on the cover. And obviously, that was influenced by my sword and sorcery TV experiences. But late in high school, I got into the Mighty Thor because I loved the mythology. And then that led me into Conan comics, and that's when I figured out, oh, this is sword and sorcery. And I actually was really into it the whole time and just didn't know it.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
I had no
So he,
idea what Mighty Max was.
man, Mighty Max is a cartoon and a toy line when I was a kid. I think Aaron and I are of similar ages. I love Mighty Max. And the people behind it clearly had a love for probably Conan, and definitely pulp stuff. So Virgil, the owl human thing that is his guide, is the last living Lemurian, which, if you're familiar with the Hyborian Age,
Right,
Lemurians are
yeah.
mentioned all the time. And then Norman the Viking is an immortal who is also supposed to be Thor, Hercules, Samson, Lancelot, and Little John. Like he's lived all these lives, which is also very, very pulp and also kind of Cain. Yeah, and it's just a kid, an 80s kid with a backwards cap, and he goes on adventures, and his main antagonist is Skull Master, which is, very
I'm seeing
Thulsa
that here.
Doom.
Yeah, I'm seeing here.
Yeah.
It's voiced by Tim Curry.
Yeah. And he just goes on all kinds of random adventures. I think You could mix Conan and like Doc Savage almost, or like Johnny Quest type stuff. There's like mad scientists and aliens and Ice Age animals and dinosaurs. It's good stuff for a kid. But he also mentioned Arrak, Son of Thunder, which is interesting, which is a sword and sorcery comic, which was DC's answer to Conan. Obviously, Conan was popular. DC was like, we got to do something to like, get some of them sales. So they came up with this Arrak character who was I believe he's an Algonquin native or an Iroquois Native American raised by Vikings. And he travels around Europe and Asia, doing sword and sorcery adventures with his Viking family or, brothers. And then there's a woman character called like the Iron Maiden. Something the Iron Maiden as well. So I would say it's like to me, I'd put it like a B tier, and I don't think about a lot of people like know about it or of it or even read it. So it's cool that like he brought that up.
I recall seeing that, and maybe I even picked up one or two, or somehow got my hands on one or two. I don't, I think I knew even then it was a Conan knockoff, and so I kind of
Yeah,
poo-pooed
definitely.
it. Yeah, so I kind of poo-pooed it, and I never bothered picking up or reading it again.
I get that sentiment, and I probably put it in the Conan knockoff side too. Obviously, people love things they love. I got nothing against that. But that's super cool. It's interesting to have that character brought up because I don't think a lot of people will probably even be familiar with that character.
Absolutely, yeah. So go check it out. Eric, Son of
Yeah.
Thunder, man, if you're a comic book collector, I bet, and you've got some of those, I bet those suckers are worth something now.
Yeah, probably.
So, okay, and here we're gonna wrap it up here with our last one. This guy just said his name is Arnold and he's from California.
No. This is tough.
Hi there, how are you? This is Arnold from California. The first time I saw sword and sorcery things of that nature was working out at Gold's Gym with Lou and with Franco Colombo, and they were looking at this piece here of the Frazetta and all of these things. And then John Milius walks in and he says, "Arnold, there you are. We don't have to build Conan. You're him." And so that was my first time seeing the Conan things, things of that nature.
Oh my God. I had no idea that was coming. But the second you said Arnold, I just knew exactly what
Yeah. So
it was.
even though Matt's not with us, he's still kind of with us, right?
Yeah, it's always
Yeah.
with us in spirit.
Oh, that was fun. Thank you all who submitted stuff, and it's fun to see and hear, I should say, hear from some of the listeners. And I don't know if we'll do anything like this again, but I kind of dig interacting with our listeners.
I really, it gives us something different to talk about.
Right.
And it feels like we have some engagement beyond our own egos.
Right.
But yeah, no, it's great. And like, I Matt and I are pretty active online. And some of those people I've interacted with fairly regularly, like one on one. It's cool that you have met some at different conventions. I did notice that I think all of them, I don't, I were from the East Coast.
What's
And
that?
I've noticed like all the people were on the east side, what I would consider the eastern half, at least, of the
Oh,
United States.
yes. Yeah.
There wasn't a single representative of the West where I am. Oh no, Austin. We had Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas, yes.
That's the
Although
closest one. And then New Zealand, depending on which way around the world you're going.
he's so far west that he's east.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
But if you're out there, guys, I know there's a lot of wide open spaces here. But I'm sitting here in New Mexico. Would be happy to meet with people.
I imagine there's got to be fans of sword and sorcery and fans
Gotta be.
of rogues in the house who live somewhere near you, What's the biggest city that you're next?
Well, I'm in Albuquerque. It's the
Oh,
biggest city in New Mexico. Yeah.
you are in Albuquerque. Okay.
Yeah. I'm in Albuquerque. We have friends in Santa Fe. My parents live in Phoenix. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure they're around. I do know of one gentleman from the Discord who lives in Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada, I believe. But that might be the only person I think that I'm aware of.
Wow. Only person.
Maybe
You're a man standing up.
on an island at the top of the world.
You're a man standing alone in your field.
Oh, I wish I was standing alone in a field. Instead, I'm in the middle of a large city.
Yeah. All right. Well, Logan, let's go ahead and wrap this up. And it was fun. It's kind of weird when we don't have Matt in the
It
middle.
is a little weird. It's weird to hear so much of our voices.
What are you saying there? What are you saying?
Nothing at all. I'm just not used to hearing so much of me.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thanks to everybody who submitted their stuff, and we'll do something maybe like this again. I don't know.
We'll figure something out.
Yeah, we'll figure something out. But until next time, I guess we got to say it together, or I don't know. What does he always say?
May your swords always remain sharp.
Yeah, you always end it with a question mark.
I love asking the question.
Yeah.
May
All
your
right.
swords always
Always
remain
remain
sharp.
sharp. No question mark added.